Hello everyone, this is Robert Velasquez, podcasting for RespiratoryCareStore.com. Today we'll be talking about the mechanism of gas exchange and respiratory insufficiency. When we breathe, air first circulates to the bronchi, followed by the bronchioles and then the terminal bronchioles, which opens up at the end to create an alveolar duct from which air sacs derive. Each lung has over 300 million alveoli, which gives a total surface area of 70 meters squared. This is a very expansive surface area for the facilitation of gas exchanges, namely oxygen and carbon dioxide. Oxygenation occurs by simple diffusion of the alveoli to the blood. In turn, CO2 is more concentrated in the blood than the alveoli, which is why it diffuses from the capillaries and into the alveolar space. Alveoli are covered by a very thin monolayer of epithelial cells that possess an excellent supply of blood, which allows O2 and CO2 to diffuse freely between the alveoli walls and capillaries. The red blood cells from the capillaries will be in charge of transporting oxygen to the cells by using an oxygen-binding protein molecule inside the cell called hemoglobin, which changes to oxyhemoglobin when bonded with oxygen. On the other hand, there are three ways humans use and expel CO2. 1. Dissolved and transported in plasma water. 2. Attached to hemoglobin, which turns it into carbaminohemoglobin. And 3. Carried as bicarbonate ions, which form part of the bicarbonate buffer system. Respiration makes use of several gas laws, including Boyle's law establishes that the pressure of a gas on a closed system is inversely proportional to the volume of the recipient if temperature remains constant. A simple way to put it would be, if gas pressure increases by X, volume decreases by X. If pressure decreases by X, volume increases by X. Then we have Fick's law of diffusion, which states that the velocity of diffusion across a bilayer membrane is directly proportional to the concentration gradient of the substance on both sides of the same, and inversely proportional to the membrane thickness. And we have Henry's law, the quantity of dissolved gas in a liquid with constant temperature is proportional to the pressure of gas in equilibrium with liquid. And we also have Dalton's law of partial pressures, which is the total pressure of a mixture of gases is the same as the sum of the pressures of each individual gas. And finally, we have the general gas law, which affirms a relationship between volume, pressure, and temperature of a constant amount of gas. The formula consists of the product of its pressure times the volume it occupies divided by the temperature. It should also be noted that respiration involves a series of known mechanisms, such as perfusion, diffusion, ventilation, and transportation of gases. So, let's talk about the definition of respiratory failure. Acute respiratory failure is the inability of the respiratory system to maintain its basic function, which is the exchange of O2 and CO2 between the blood and in the environment. It's diagnosed via gasometry, which also provides CO2 levels, degree of severity, and any notable imbalance in pH. The classification of respiratory failure, from here on out we'll refer to it as RF, refers to the quantitative level of gas. Type 1 is hypoxemic, type 2 is hypercapnic, type 3 is perioperative respiratory failure, RF, and type 4 is basically shock. Now, to add context to what this means in terms of oxygen saturation, consider that a 90-92% oxygen saturation is equivalent to a PaO2 of 60 to 65 millimeter mercury, or mercury millimeter. PaO2 being the partial pressure of oxygen. Now, it's important to mention that a situation where hypoxemia occurs without the respiratory tract being deficient can arise. This can happen when we breathe air with a low partial pressure of oxygen, such as is the case in high altitudes. There's a direct relationship between the concentration of oxygen in the air of the environment, or FiO2, and PaO2. Typically, the air we breathe is made up of 21% oxygen, 78% nitrogen, and just 1% of trace elements. However, in high altitudes, atmospheric pressure is less than at sea level surfaces, which results in a partial pressure of oxygen that is lower than physiologically optimal. As a consequence, so will be the alveolar partial pressure, which is also PaO2, except that the A is capitalized, instead of arterial pressure, which would be with a lowercase a when you spell it out. Now, according to a national survey conducted by Mihaela Stefan to determine the prognosis of acute respiratory failure in the U.S., it showed that, quote, over the period of 2001 to 2009, there was a steady increase in the number of hospitalizations with a discharge diagnosis of acute respiratory failure with a decrease in inpatient mortality, end quote. So there's about four pathophysiological mechanisms of hypoxemia. One is hypoventilation, there's diffusion alterations, pulmonary shunt, and a mismatch in the VQ. As far as hypoventilation, hypoxemia is present in all types of respiratory insufficiency, but in this case it's accompanied by retention of carbon dioxide. The production of CO2 occurs as a consequence of metabolic processes and is measured as VCO2, or volume of carbon dioxide expelled. As we've mentioned, the only way to get rid of CO2 is via respiration. Hypoventilation refers to a physiological disorder of respiration in which several pathological situations lead to alveolar hypoventilation, which is confirmed by pulse oximetry or capnography. The result is an increase of PaCO2 and decrease of PaO2. Hypoventilation manifests with superficial or slow-like breathing that results in an insufficient amount of alveolar airflow, and thus an inadequate partial pressure of oxygen in arterial blood takes place. This is accompanied by an increase of the partial pressure of CO2. If it persists, a drop in the acidity of the blood will occur and is called respiratory acidosis. With ventilation, air is passed along the alveolar capillary membrane for gas exchange. This alveolar ventilation, known as VA, depends on the respiratory minute volume, or VE, and dead space ventilation, VD. It's expressed by the equation VA equals VE minus VD. The majority of situations in which VA lowers are due to the decrease in respiratory minute volume. A reduction of dead space ventilation is very infrequent. Therefore, the existence of hypoventilation leads to an elevation of PCO2, which is inversely proportional to decrease in alveolar ventilation. Further, considering the alveolar ventilation equation and a respiratory quotient of 1, which is a ratio between the volumes of CO2 produced by an organism and the volume of oxygen that it consumes, for every rise in 1 millimeter mercury of CO2, a descension of 1 millimeter mercury PaO2 will occur. Causes that lead to hypoventilation seldom originate in the pulmonary parenchyma. They're more frequent from extrapulmonary tissue. Moving on to diffusion alterations. Once oxygen reaches the alveoli, it must be exchanged with blood gases for distribution via passive diffusion, which is regulated by the physical laws of the diffusion of gases. However, diffusion plays a lesser role in respiratory insufficiency when compared to imbalances of VQ. By the way, VQ is ventilation perfusion. So, when compared to imbalances of VQ and pulmonary shunts, both of which play a crucial role in PO2, diffusion is a more important factor during exercise since the capillary transit time decreases with physical activity. When at rest, diffusion does not have a functional repercussion since the transit time of blood through the capillary allows the lung to reach an equilibrium between PaO2 and the PO2 in the capillary. Under normal conditions, this balance is achieved when the blood has traveled a third of the length of the capillary. With respect to the elimination of CO2, slight hypocapnia is normal since CO2 has a rate of diffusion 20 times higher than O2. Pulmonary shunt. A shunt is an increase of the AA gradient of O2 during respiration. Normally, partial pressure of oxygen in the alveolus should be approximately equal to arterial partial pressure. So let's say there is 100 millimeter mercury of PaO2. In healthy individuals, this would translate to a partial pressure of 100 millimeter mercury. Shunting is used to describe a situation where Alveolar partial pressure of oxygen is 100 millimeter mercury, but partial pressure of oxygen is abnormally less. For example, 70 millimeter mercury. So this represents an AA gradient of just 30. An AA gradient calculation is simple subtraction. It's alveolar, it's the partial pressure of oxygen, alveolar partial pressure of oxygen minus partial pressure of oxygen, that equals the AA gradient. Under normal circumstances, healthy people present physiological shunting with an AA gradient range of 5 to 15. What all of this means is that deoxygenated blood mixes with oxygenated blood. The perfusion of blood may be just fine, but for various reasons, ventilation is zero, resulting in an extreme imbalance of VQ. Intrapulmonary shunting can be the result of abnormal communications between arteries and veins, such as arteriovenous fistulas or cardiac septal defects. With this said, the most frequent causes of shunt development are cardiogenic edemas, atelectasias, pneumonia, acute respiratory distress syndrome, and alveolar collapse. Perfusion is maintained, but there is no oxygenation for the blood that passes through. Intrapulmonary shunting is the main cause of hypoxemia and is normally accompanied by hypocapnia. The VQ mismatch. A ventilation-perfusion mismatch is the most important pathophysiological mechanism of respiratory insufficiency, as it is the most frequent mechanism of hypoxemia in the majority of obstructive, vascular, and interstitial pulmonary diseases. The lungs are made up of millions of alveoli, each one with a predetermined ventilation and perfusion capacity. In ideal conditions, the ratio of each is 1, but this relationship can in theory vary from 0 to infinity. The existence of VQ inequalities means that ventilation and blood flow do not concur in different regions of the lung, resulting in an inefficient exchange of gases. One way to evaluate the severity of VQ imbalance is measuring the AA gradient. The higher the gradient, the more severe the imbalance of VQ. In this mechanism, we can find alveoli with low VQ in which diminished ventilation with adequate perfusion exists. However, compensatory mechanisms tend to resolve the situation by lowering the perfusion between alveoli and capillaries via hypoxic vasoconstriction and rerouting them to other areas of good ventilation. There are also situations when VQ is elevated, where ventilation is good but perfusion inadequate. Here, bronchoconstriction can take place, where ventilation can be rerouted to areas with good perfusion. At first, hypoxemia gets corrected by hypoxic stimulus to ventilation, which is why hypercapnia is rare in the initial phases, but afterwards, when VQ imbalances are severe, hypercapnia appears. The resulting hypoxemia can be corrected by taking supplemental oxygen. It should be noted that quite often the mechanisms involved in hypoxemia tend to be numerous, where it's difficult to attribute hypoxemia to just one. Mechanisms that lead to hypercapnia are hypoventilation and alterations in the VQ relationship. Pathophysiological mechanisms of hypercapnia. So there's a few. Increased CO2 production, hypoventilation, rebreathing, decreased alveolar ventilation, and increased dead space. Diagnosis of acute respiratory failure. RF can be inferred by the presence of symptoms and signs of hypoxemia and or hypercapnia, especially in patients who have been diagnosed with acute or chronic pulmonary or non-pulmonary diseases. Symptoms include acute thoracic pain, hemoptysis, confusion, rapid breathing, cyanotic skin, fatigue, and sleepiness. Arterial saturation, or SaO2 readings, can be obtained with the use of pulse oximeters, which are non-invasive devices that allow the monitoring of SaO2. However, saturation can be affected by an underlying condition such as anemia. Normally, a saturation of 90% corresponds to 60 millimeters mercury of PaO2, but we need to keep in mind that the oxygen dissociation curve varies according to the degree of the existing affinity between hemoglobin and oxygen, which is influenced by temperature, intra-erythrocytic concentration of 2,3 biphosphoglyceric acid, CO2 tension, and acidity of the environment. Acidosis, hypercapnia, and hyperthermia produce a deviation in the oxygen-hemoglobin dissociation curve towards the right, which reflects a decrease in affinity of the hemoglobin-oxygen bond affinity. This facilitates the liberation of oxygen to tissue. A radiography of the thorax can help with differential diagnosis. Other complementary tests are gammography and CT scan if a thromboembolism is suspected. Treatment for respiratory failure begins with targeting the culprit of an underlying causal disease, such as pneumonia and antimicrobial therapy. As for the respiratory failure itself, it's usually handled with the following considerations. Securement of airways by removing foreign bodies, secretions, etc. Orotracheal intubation, if necessary. Monitoring of SaO2 and vitals. Venous catheterization. Treating or preventing oxygen consumption increase due to fever or general activity. Nutrition and hydration. Treatment for anemia and hypotension to improve oxygen saturation and distribution. Prophylaxis against thromboembolic processes. Let's look at oxygen therapy real quick. So by maintaining proper tissue oxygenation, the patient can balance oxygen levels and improve the quality of oxygen in the blood. However, oxygen therapy should be based on the results of a gasometry. Once determined, oxygen therapy is appropriate. O2 should be administered through a Venturi mask, with which we can know the fraction of inspired oxygen provided to the patient. A target SaO2 above 90% should be maintained for chronic cases that become acute or if the patient presents a hypercapnic tendency. In the same token, cardiac output and the transportation of O2 needs to be stabilized. Non-invasive ventilation has demonstrated its efficacy in patients with episodes of acute COPD or chronic obstructive pulmonary disorder, acidosis, hypercapnia. Additionally, the need for intubation and mechanical ventilation is reduced with non-invasive ventilation, as is mortality rate and length of hospital stay. An analysis made by Nicolina Maric and colleagues showed steady increments in non-invasive ventilation from 2011 to 2015. According to this study, quote, three Italian cohort studies with historical or matched control groups have suggested that long-term outcome of patients treated with non-invasive ventilation is better than that of patients treated with medical therapy and or endotracheal intubation, end quote. That was from Dr. Maric. So that's it for me today. Thank you very much for tuning in. Again, this is Robert Velasquez, podcasting for Respiratory Care Store. Until next time.